Every day, migrants seeking a better life in the United States travel across its southern border. But what awaits them on the other side? This is James Naughty, and you're listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. This is Heart and Soul, exploring personal experiences of spirituality and faith. In the recent American presidential campaign, immigration and what happens along the border was a centerpiece of Donald Trump's appeal. He's promised to tighten border controls, reduce crossings, and deport potentially millions of people. Well, in this program, we're putting aside the political rhetoric and talking instead to people on the front line. During that election campaign, I traveled to Tucson in Arizona, very close to the border, and spent time there with people from the city who feel driven to protect migrants from harm. Sunday morning, Sarah Roberts is in the congregation at Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson.
I was moved by my faith, you know, to get involved. You know, Matthew 25 was one of the inspirational scriptures. Matthew 25 has to do with Jesus saying, if you give water or food to the least of these, you're giving it to me. And so it carries that message forward. But not everybody are people of faith, right? People of faith and conscience is how we say people that founded these movements.
We're 70 miles north of the border here and the famous wall, which, although incomplete, snakes across long parts of it. And this is one of the places where migrants arrive, whether they're seeking asylum by arguing that they've had good reason to flee to the United States, or whether they've made a perilous undercover journey through the desert, a trek that costs many lives in the wilderness. For Sarah and other members of her church, standing on the sidelines wasn't an acceptable option. They felt they had to do something to help. For this program, I spent time with Sarah and others, talking about the choices they've made and about what the border and the people crossing it mean to them.
Yeah, every morning at 6:30, we have a raffle. It establishes the order of the list of how people go out to work.
So they get the first choice of a job.
Yes, that's right. So the first employer that comes by, then the first person on the list will be assigned to that job.
Wednesday morning, 6:30. Migrants who want to work are outside the church, on the street, waiting to see if someone wants to hire them for the day. Sarah and her colleagues are helping to organize this unofficial labor market.
These are day labor jobs, yeah, construction, landscaping, digging trenches, whatever needs to be done. This corner of town has a long, long history of being a space where people could wait for work, for day labor jobs, and a safe place. It's on the property of the church, Southside Presbyterian Church. It's not a space that will be invaded by law enforcement or Border Patrol.
Well, they tend to leave it alone, do they?
They tend to leave it alone, yeah. There's an agreement that they don't come on properties of places of worship unless they're in hot pursuit of someone that committed a crime.
Yeah. As we talk, a few trucks pull up, the drivers offering a day's work to some of the 50 or so people who are standing around under the trees. But by the time we leave, an hour and a half later, very few of them have had an offer. This is a tough place to find work. Sarah tells me that her church has been involved in this kind of activity for more than 40 years.
People were fleeing to save their lives and coming to the United States to escape the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala. And that's when this movement was founded.
The reasons for migration are always changing, and the stories of those who get to the border reflect a spectrum of experiences, war in countries far away, crime and drug-filled streets at home that they want to escape, poverty. But the end result is the same, a desire to get away. And millions of people have come across the border into the United States over the years. 15 years ago, long after the first wave of activism here, Sarah, who's a retired nurse, felt drawn to her church's tradition of help to give her own Christian response to the border crisis.
People were losing their lives. And so we began to brainstorm and how can we end the death and suffering? And so the first response was humane borders, to put the 55-gallon water drums out there. You'll probably see that today. And then, you know, Tucson Samaritans was formed in 2002 because we really wanted to have a presence out there, medical people, providing medical attention, food and water to migrants crossing through the desert. So we gave first aid training and formed the Samaritans, and we've been out there ever since.
So in this program from the BBC World Service, I'm traveling from Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson down to the border, and then 20 miles or so east along it, to a camp at the end of the border wall, a place where it stops and the desert takes over. I'm joining Gail Kosarek from the Tucson Samaritans, driving down roads and tracks that she knows very well.
These are little stuffed animals, and we run into children, and they're usually pretty traumatized by their experience, but if you give them something like that, it's theirs. It means a lot to them.
Most of these Tucson Samaritans exists to help people in emergencies. So for our journey, Gail packs the car full of water, food, and little toys for traumatized children that she knows she's going to encounter.
It's, you know, probably one of the shorter people that drives the vehicle.
We've got a bumpy drive ahead. As we go, Gail has a lot to share about the situation she's dealing with. We leave the city. Soon we're in the Sonoran Desert. Looking out from the car across the scrub, where cactuses sprout up from the dirt, we see the occasional flag fluttering on a high pole.
There's the flag. See it flying up there? So I think a migrant would see that and they go, oh, there must be something there. There's a flag. You know, and there is something there. There's a tank of water. The flags have to be changed constantly. The wind just wrecks havoc. So what I'm going to do is I have to get out and check to make sure nobody's drained it.
Gail pulls over to check the huge water butts, making sure they haven't been drained or sabotaged by some of the vigilantes who, angry at these illegal border crossings, attempt to impede the migrants who are trying to get through. One of the Samaritans' sister organisations leaves these signposts so that migrants might see them and get life-preserving water in this unforgiving heat.
You can feel a temperature change when you rub your hand down it. Feel how much cooler it is down there?
This one is cooler on the bottom than on the top, which means there's still water in it. We move on. But it's not long before Gail pulls the car over again, pointing into the scrub.
See the cross right here? There's another one over here on the other side on the little hill. And this one here, it's part of a program called Where Dreams Die. It's where migrant human remains were found. And we have a guy, Alvaro Enciso, who's from Colombia originally. And Alvaro puts four crosses out a week, and every one of those crosses has a red dot on it. His idea, he's an artist, is that someday the wood will be gone, but the little red dots might still be there, and people will want to know and maybe look it up and find out how horrible we were to people to help bring on so many deaths every year. Last year, I think there were around 190 recovered human remains in our area.
We're drawing closer to the border now, where for more than 30 years, administrations in Washington have extended the wall that's meant to keep people out.
The people that we meet along the wall, they're two different kinds of migrants. They're the asylum seekers, and those are the ones we deal with the most. And there are the travelers. And the travelers are the ones that walk across these mountains and end up dying, a lot of them, out in the desert. And they don't have any idea how many tried to cross. They really don't know how many people have died. Usually they find them pretty fast because of the vultures or other migrants will report seeing a body. But if you ran and you got lost and you tripped and fell and died, you, for a good chance, you're just going to go back to dust.
approaching the wall now, you can just see the first outline of it. A dark line against the hills. There's blazing sunshine.
You'll find when we get up there, it'll be really weird. You'll go at 30 feet and all of a sudden it drops 15 feet. And that's a wall that Clinton put in. President Clinton put in the 15-foot wall for a few miles in both ways to stop drug running. So that, you know, we had the Clinton wall, the Bush wall, and the Trump wall. And the Trump wall is a 30-footer. But they're all breachable. It's easy. You could cut right through them. You could go over, under, or through. It's up to you. I'll show you places.
Looking at the road ahead of us, you know, stretching into the distance, away towards the mountains, in a way it looks like any other road in Arizona, straight and brown and sandy. But this one is quite different, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's got an eyesore next to it. It's got a porous wall, a money pit wall, a boondoggle of a wall. In fact, I call it the Trump-Biden boondoggle because it's a big, incredible $400 billion boondoggle that we could have used to solve the issue, to have a work visitor program, to have a workable immigration program instead of this eyesore that doesn't work. Okay, see, this was breached and then welded shut. So it's at least three or four breaches just in this area. Right here. That was breached and welded shut.
You're listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. This is James Naughty, and for Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service, I've come to the United States border with Mexico. I'm with Gail Kosarek, a humanitarian volunteer with the NGO Tucson Samaritans. She's driving me along the border wall. In fact, it's a high barrier of vertical metal bars. She points out places where the wall's been cut open by traffickers who've been paid to get people up to the Mexican side of the border and then through the wall into the United States. You can see where authorities have welded back the gaps afterwards to try to secure the barrier again.
Sometimes people think I sound anti-American, and I say, you know, I love my country, I love being an American, I'm very disappointed in a lot of the people, I'm disappointed in the entitlement, it really disappoints me, the way a lot of Americans act. It's heartbreaking to me.
We drive towards the end of this section of wall, Gail explaining that President Joe Biden, under political pressure to cut the number of migrants, has recently tightened the country's asylum policy, making it harder, she says, for people coming across the border into the United States to make a legitimate claim that they're in danger and need protection or asylum under international law. And then we're there. Suddenly the wall is no more. We're at the end. Silence for a moment, then Gail is out of the car, sorting out her supplies.
I'll take out. Usually the sausages aren't popular because they're a lot of Muslims here and they usually don't eat that stuff. Mexicans will eat it. It might be easier if we just... if we could carry this over to the tent.
We walk a few metres to a tent close by on the rocky dirt track, and there we find some of the migrants who've come across the border in the last few hours.
Two times I went there. Oh. It's beautiful. Beautiful people.
Now politics is very bad, man. What to do?
She meets a man who's travelled thousands of miles from Nepal over many, many months to claim asylum here.
Do you have family in the United States?
No, we don't have many family here. Yeah.
So are you all planning on going to New York?
No, I don't. We don't know the easy other before. We just meet in Mexico.
Met here.
Yeah, we just meet in the Mexico.
Okay. And here comes Border Patrol. So you may be leaving right now.
Okay, man. Thank you, man.
Namaste.
Thank you, sir.
Here we are in degrees that are
getting very high, probably 40 degrees, 100 plus, and there's a little makeshift camp here on the edge of the scrub desert, a couple of tents. There were 28 people who went across here last night. There are little family groups here, a family with a child of 18 months has just been taken away by Border Patrol to be processed.
They're going to take families first, usually families with children first, unaccompanied minors definitely first.
Yeah, we have one 15-year-old boy also.
Unaccompanied?
And this young child, 18 months old,
With daddy.
In the arms of her father.
He's got daddy.
Who's not surprisingly slightly confused.
Yes. Oh, some of these children are terribly traumatized.
As she'd promised, Gail makes sure the child gets one of the toys she'd packed before we set out. It's a pretty desperate scene. For all the efforts of Gail and the Tucson Samaritans trying to bring humanity to bear here, it remains a desolate place. Two or three tents help to shield groups of disoriented people from the intense heat. They're a few meters inside the United States, with an empty landscape ahead of them, waiting for Border Patrol officers and their pickup trucks to come for them. As the processing begins, Gail introduces Andy Winter. He's a volunteer. His home is 2,500 miles away in the northeast United States. He's come all the way here, staying out in the desert at night, to care for people if they get across the border.
Yeah. Are they hoping to apply for asylum?
Yes, everyone here is applying for asylum.
To go through the system,
yeah.
Because they believe they have a story to tell that is credible.
They're hoping. Right now, unfortunately, there's not many people listening. It's a difficult time for people seeking asylum.
So where will they be taken to now?
They'll go to the Sasebo station, which is about 25 miles down this road, and they'll be processed there initially, fingerprinted, photos, and then they'll be taken to Tucson, hopefully, for an
assessment.
They're supposed to, but apparently that assessment isn't happening very frequently at the moment. So I was just down in Nogales yesterday.
On the Mexican side of the border.
Families we saw 4 days ago here have already been deported into Nogales. So there are women, children. If this looks difficult, which is, it's hard to imagine this. And then you see them 5 days later after being incarcerated and then put back over the other side with only the clothing they're wearing. Sometimes it's only a paper shirt, their phone, their documents. No socks, no shoelaces, no anything. It was just, heartbreaking.
We're at the end of the wall now, and there is a wilderness going into the mountains beyond it. But I suppose people who have wanted the wall to be built and have argued that it would be a deterrent would say, well, the people we've just seen here wouldn't have got here if the wall had just carried on, so keep building it, make it higher, make it longer. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that?
Well, then people just climb over, or they cut. It takes about 30 minutes to cut a hole in the wall, and then it takes about 30 more minutes to put 200 people through that hole. So that's what's happening. All along this wall, it's being cut on a daily basis.
These are the cuts that Gail showed me on the drive over, and Andy thinks it's pretty obvious why people continue to come.
I mean, if you're fleeing for your life, would you let a wall stop you? Would you let a desert stop you? Or if your kids are starving, or if your family's being threatened, and you know the threat where you are, and you know you can't stay there, you have to leave. I mean, any decent parent, any decent husband, any decent mom would do everything they can to protect their families.
A few years ago, when this started, like in 2019, they said that the cartel came into their houses. She put her kids, she grabbed her kids and just ran for the border. No looking back, no taking anything, just getting out of there. Can you blame them?
It's not just what migrants are leaving behind. The NGO Doctors Without Borders, operating in many countries along the route from South America, says that last year, cases of sexual assault and rape along the way increased significantly. Women in particular are left with terrible options.
Having talked to women who are willing to talk about it, many take birth control before the journey, expecting to be raped, but they don't want to be pregnant also.
But even horror stories like these don't seem to put people off from coming. Andy told me about one of the migrants who'd arrived that very morning, a 15-year-old Mexican boy who said he was fleeing the cartels.
he didn't want to be part of that. And so his family couldn't afford to come, so they pooled their money and they paid for him to be able to make the journey. And he was lucky to make it this far. I would guess I'll see him in Nogales, deported in 4 days probably.
Deported back to Mexico.
I would have to guess. I mean, I would be very surprised if not. Right now, just politically, right now, they're really short-circuiting the whole asylum process. His odds are very slim if he's from Mexico.
As we're talking, Gail points down the track. Another Border Patrol officer is pulling up to pick up more migrants.
He's a good Border Patrol. Hector, we have a woman over here. Do you want her?
Just one?
Just one?
Is she okay?
Just one? Yes, she's from Nepal.
I'll bring her right back.
Okay.
I'll come back. Okay.
For all of the migrants' hopes, as they climb into the Border Patrol truck and drive away, Andy Winter thinks that the next time he'll see them, they'll be back in Mexico, their asylum requests turned down. Then he points to something else on the other side of the wall, inside Mexico, in the brush, just a few meters from where we're standing.
So just on the other side of the wall, if you look and go to it, you'll see there are more groups of people waiting on the other side who know that they won't probably make it through the asylum process. Oh, look, we're being signaled at the top of that. See? At the top of that. So he's either letting us know people are coming or he's signaling someone. Do you see that light flashing? At the top of the hill. That's a lookout up there. And you can see people under that tree there.
These are likely cartel members, traffickers, who've brought these migrants to this point in the middle of the desert, having made them pay first. Andy explains that, unlike the people we met who are seeking asylum, many of these migrants will try to cross illegally.
And so there's people also who try and cross the desert because they know either the asylum process failed them already, but their family's in the States, and they just don't want to live without their family. And so they'll take their chances and cross the desert at night.
But how hazardous? We're standing here in, you know, very, very high temperatures.
It's probably 102 right now, I'd say. And then with the, you know, the radiant heat off the ground, probably hotter than that.
And the terrain that we're looking into there, into those Arizona hills, is extremely unforgiving.
Yeah,
we've seen on the way here the crosses by the roadside, which indicate places where human remains have been found, people who simply perished, heat stroke or whatever.
Yeah. It's very common. I mean, I have a bunch of friends who patrol the desert looking for people, and a woman just found someone last week. She got a call that there was someone in distress in the desert, and by the time she reached him, he had died already. And we found a man on the road yesterday trying to walk to town who was unconscious, and had we not come across him, I don't know if he'd have made it.
This place, these stories, are desperately sad. So why did Andy choose to come and spend weeks at a time here, so far away from home, living in an unforgiving environment?
Because I have friends all over the world, and there are a lot of circumstances that are unlivable currently, and folks are fleeing those circumstances, and they end up here, hoping to start a new life. And I'm here because if ever I have to do that for my family or with my family, or if my daughter has to do that, I hope someone shows up to help her. It's really that simple.
This is where the political arguments about migration are distilled in the heat. Here, the raw political debate seems quite distant from the human story played out day after day at this wall and in the desert where we know people will continue to perish as they head north in search of a new life. For Andy Winter, despite the challenges, the discomfort, the disappointments, the obligation to offer help seems to him to be the true spirit of his country.
To me, if you want to make America great again, this is what made it great in the first place. My grandparents came over. You know, my great-great-grandfather was 16, and he came over on a boat.
And here you are.
And here I am, right? And I had the fortune of a dad who worked in a factory in Detroit, and my mom was the first college graduate and her family, you know, and they helped me get through college, and I paid for college, and I got a master's degree, and I, you know, I've had a really nice life, and my daughter's off in college now, and now I have time, and it's like, I feel like it's time to give back. You know, I've gotten so much, and I just can't see people suffer. This is my country. I can't see people suffer like this without showing up and at least trying to help a little. Sorry, just, you know, after yesterday in Nogales, it's, just seeing what's happening there. I mean, this level of desperation times 100, because all their hopes now have been dashed.
You could say that Andy's hopes have been dashed too, and Gail's, but they're still offering what respite they can to the people in this makeshift camp at the end of the wall. That's exactly what Sarah Roberts talked about at the start of this program, quoting the Bible, Jesus saying, "If you give water or food to the least of these, you're giving it to me." The election showed that in a variety of different ways, people want this problem to be fixed. For politicians to find agreement on a plan that could ease the crisis along the whole length of America's southern border. From January 2025, Donald Trump will again have the responsibility for fixing it. For now, the crossings and the suffering continue. At the End of the Wall, from the BBC World Service, was presented by me, James Naughtie. The producer was Giles Edwards.